KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. That is what it's all about, and we're going to talk a little bit about it tonight on Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to it here. Good evening to y'all, good morning or good day, whomever you might be, wherever you might be, welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for a whole lot of good things, and it's a pleasure to be with y'all tonight. I look forward to a fun show. Actually, a special show tonight in honor of my old friend and teacher, Terrence McKenna. He would have been 61 years old this last Friday on the 16th of November, so a little something special for tea tonight, all right? Before we get things going, though, let's give a quick thanks to Corey, New Wave Radio Theater. Once again, Moon Over Morocco. I'm glad that the web stream is up and running and everyone's been able to listen to that program. A lot of people interested in following along there. So thanks to Corey for New Wave Radio Theater. She does it every Monday, an hour before this program at 10 p.m., and Angela sitting sidestep with Corey tonight. Thanks to both of them. And if you want to hear some great jazz music, you check out Angela on Thursday night from 8 until 10. You'll hear a great jazz program as well, okay? Okay, let's see. Before Corey, of course, New Wave Radio Theater is the program she does, but right before that, between 7 and 10 p.m., is Kelvin, and tonight, Eric the Red, doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals the end of history. Tech radio, before those guys, they keep us up on the outrageous world of high technology. Jeff Wheeler starts things off every Monday. Uncommon Light from 3 to 5 p.m. Good music, good talk, good news. Radio eschatology on a beautiful Monday night here in Columbia, Missouri. The moon's about half full and growing by the moment. It's the 19th of November and it's 70 degrees outside. Regardless, you're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. It's a great experience to be here with you tonight, and I love it every week. So let's do it up again, and say thank you to Mr. Larry Evans, actually, the director of the Western Montana Mycological Association. Larry was on the program last week. He's a wizard, you know, with regard to all things mushroom. So thanks again to Larry. And also, Larry provided the music for last week's program as well. And if you're interested in any of the above, The musicians that are featured on the program, including the fungal boogeyman himself, Larry Evans, can be found on the website. Just go on over to the music archives section. Tonight, speaking of music, we will have the music of John Cale. And John is a young man who I was introduced to about a year ago, probably. I was hoping to have a talk with him tonight before we went into sort of the meat of the program around midnight or so. But John's feeling a little bit under the weather and was not available to talk with us tonight. So instead of having the man on the air with us, we'll just play a bunch of his music, okay? Anyway, John Cale is a great musical artist and a visual artist as well. And he's written a very interesting little book that he sent to me, and just a talented man in general. So I'm pleased to be able to share some of his musical art with you tonight. That's John Cale. And again, you can find information about him on the web at johncale.com, J-O-H-N-K-A-L-E, or you can link over there directly from my site as always, okay? Okay, if you missed the program last week with Larry Evans, or any of the other ones for that matter, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the website at www.mikehagan.com in the program archives. See what you think and listen in. Share it with others if you think they might enjoy it, okay? Okay, tonight, as I said, or maybe I didn't say, but we will do a tribute to Terrence McKenna. He was a close friend of mine and the most amazing teacher I ever had in my 43 years. He was born on the 16th of November in 1946. He passed over to the ancestors on the 3rd of April in the year 2000, some 7 years ago. I'll not be saying too much then, actually. I'm just going to let Terrence the man speak to you in his own words for the most part. I'll fill in around him a little bit with the wonderful musical art of John Cale, and we'll do a little birthday party action for Terrence McKenna tonight, all right? And I think what we'll do here is, I'm going to tell you a story, actually, before I play another piece of music. Those of you familiar with Terrence knew that the word synchronicity was, you know, a prominent one in his lexicon, and that, of course, came out of the Jungian psychological model that that Carl Jung was so instrumental in. And synchronicity is just one of these strange things that Terrence used to talk about that he claimed would, as we approached the end of history, increase and become more and more pronounced, to the point where it became actually excruciatingly obvious that things were very, very strange that were actually occurring. And I had a really interesting synchronistic moment tonight, and actually it's a series of moments that are ongoing, with a friend of mine whose name is Butch. And Butch is a listener of the program who's been listening to the show for at least a couple years, two or three years for sure, and we've conversed over email now and again, and he's been a supporter of the radio station and my program here. But anyway, he lives in Montana, speaking of Larry Evans. But anyway, Butch lives in northern Montana, very close to the Canadian border, and he's on his way to Atlanta, Georgia. And, of course, I-70 goes, sort of splits the country, you know, in a way between here and there. And Butch found his way onto I-70, was in between Kansas City and St. Louis, approached Columbia, and realized that that's where KOPN was, and actually turned the radio station on and was listening to Corey's program before mine, and then decided that he was going to try to find me and find the station. So anyway, he ended up at the Blue Fugue, which is this little club musical place that I hang out at before the radio program, usually on Monday nights. And we met, and anyway, he's here with me now in the studio, actually. And if you'd like to say hi, you're welcome to grab a microphone, Butch, and say hello. Grab that one that's right in front of you.
Hello, America. How is everybody? Happy birthday, Mr. McKenna.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I tell you what, it's a privilege when somebody does this. I mean, for me, I mean, I feel like I couldn't be more excited. I mean, you know, somebody who listens to the show from a long way away and just happened to be passing through here on a Monday night decided to stop, and here he is, you know, chatting with us on the radio. So anyway, Butch, thank you so much for coming down. I want to let you know how much I appreciate it. It's awesome.
I'm still in shock. I'm honored. Truly honored.
Well, it's a pleasure, and we can hang out as long as you like, and we will listen to a little bit of the spoken word from Terrence McKenna, okay? All right. Hello to everybody else listening out there this evening on KOPN, over the traditional airwaves or over the internet, live or otherwise. Every Monday we broadcast this program from the wonderful studios here at KOPN in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live, also on the web, at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button once you get over to over there to the website, and you'll get a nice 64K stream and be able to hear everything that we're doing here at the station 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anywhere on the planet, as long as you have a decent internet connection. And we do the same on our end, of course. Everything's about, two-way streets. So anyway, thanks to everybody who makes that happen, live on the radio, live on the internet, and it's just a privilege to be able to participate in the endeavor here at KOPN and to be able to do Radio Orbit on this program and to share it with everybody out there. So anyway, it's a great a thrill for me every week, and this week no different, okay? I also want to say thank you to Larry, my webmaster, Larry the Web Wizard. Just an amazing guy who has helped me out a tremendous amount over the last few years and always back there behind the scenes making sure the website is up and running and acting the way it's supposed to. We made an update on the forum, by the way. For people who use the forum, we updated to a more current version of the software, and I think it'll solve some of those bug problems that we were having last week, okay? Speaking of the forum, that is an interesting part of the website. If you navigate over to MikeHagan.com, just point your mouse over there, you'll have access to everything that we're doing. And there is a forum, a bulletin board type thing that is always busy and active, and lots of interesting people and topics being discussed over there. And, you're welcome to join in the mix. And it's a great place to post news and information and opinion and, video, audio, anything you like. It's a great way to communicate and share information with other people. So we do that around the week, not just on Monday nights. The forum's always active around the clock, pretty much. And we also have a live chat room that is up and active, certainly tonight, right now. I'll have to sneak over there in a few minutes. But again, something that can be utilized anytime, whether we're on the air or not. Okay, so I always encourage the listeners and guests to join us in the forum or the chat, and it's a great opportunity to get to know each other and share a little bit about what we're all thinking about, what's happening on this crazy planet of ours, okay? All right, we will peek in there in the chat room in just a little bit, okay? And my email address is orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio at AOL.com. And the website, of course, Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. Send email. Myself, the guests, the musicians that appear on the program, everybody likes to hear from you. So if you've got something to say, certainly feel free to and share your thoughts with us, because it's, as I mentioned just a moment ago, two-way streets. And, I blast the message out here from the 40,000-watt tower at KOPN, and the main reason I do it is because I'm doing what the theme of my program says I'm doing. It says I'm looking for the others. I'm trying to find the others, and so I'm sending my message out there to you as best I can. And I'd like, love certainly, to have messages come back. So that's the whole business of communication. It's two-way streets, relationships, and this sort of thing. So anyway, long story short, send me email. Okay. All right. Upcoming guests. Tonight, as I mentioned, we'll do a special tribute to Terrence McKenna. He would have been 61 years old this last Friday on the 16th of November. He was a shaman from Colorado, altar boy in the Catholic Church, who turned into the most amazing person that I've ever run across in my 43 years. And I could play lectures and tapes and concerts and things that he did over the course of his career, which was too short, but long enough, and we could do it all night if we had the time. But tonight I'll play a couple of excerpts from a lecture that he gave about 17 years ago in California. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a little while, okay? All right, that's tonight, though. Terrence McKenna, on the 19th of November, his birthday just a few days ago. And next week we will have Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. Now, for people in the physics world, in the physical sciences, if you know a reasonable amount about your history, you'll recognize the name Elizabeth Rauscher. She's, for 35, going on 40 years, been one of the most prominent physics scientists in the areas of plasma physics, nuclear physics, and now moving into alternative energy and doing some very, very interesting work with Nassim Haramein at the Resonance Project. And Nassim was on the program about 18 months ago or so, and I'm working on getting him back on the program. But Elizabeth Rauscher is the scientific side of that particular equation. She's a brilliant physicist and is recognized as such by many, many people around the world. And I'm just thrilled, and it's a privilege to have Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher on the radio program next week. So we'll be talking about alternative energy and the way the world works, essentially, on a physical level with Elizabeth Rauscher next week, okay? On the 3rd of December, Paco Almgren. He's an author of a novel, a work of fiction. It's called Discipline, but it's a work of fiction that has a lot of basis in fact, and it'll be a fun and interesting talk, I think, with Paco Almgren, the author of Discipline, on the 12th of December, in just a couple weeks. What else? Richard Allen Miller, on the 10th of December. Richard back by popular demand. I'm not sure what we'll talk about, alchemy or, you know, individual home farming or mushrooms or pine cone delivery. You never know with Richard. Maybe we'll talk about the NSA and all the spooks that are running around telling secrets, and he's still involved in that gang as well. Richard Miller, of course, was NSA for years in the late 60s and the 70s, and he tells just amazing stories about that stuff if you're interested in the conspiratorial side of things. You know, the world really is different and more strange than anybody ever imagined. And Terence used to say, not only is the world stranger than you suppose it is, it's stranger than you can suppose it is. And the more I learn about it, the more I experience it, it actually is like that. I'm constantly blown away by the strangeness of my own life. And, you know, I mean, that's enough, I guess. Anything outside of your own experience these days is sort of unconfirmed rumor. But, God, I mean, that's strange, too. But in my own world, literally in my own space, I see the world as just an amazingly interesting, strange, and mysterious, confounding at times, place. And it's just a remarkable situation that we're all here and able to talk about it. So, anyway, Richard Allen Miller, back on the 12th, I take that back, on the 10th of December. Jonathan Zapp, he'll be coming back at the beginning of the year. I talked to Paul Laffoley tonight. I had this sort of a conk on the head earlier when I heard someone on NPR talking about the woman from Alice's Restaurant. I think her name is Alice Brock. You know, they wrote the song. Was it Woody Guthrie, right? Woody Guthrie wrote Arlo Guthrie, yeah. Arlo Guthrie wrote Alice's Restaurant, and there's actually a woman, and that was actually a real place, and a lot of interesting things happened there. But at any rate, the woman, Alice Brock, I think is her name, turns out she's still around, and she's an artist in Boston, and she has her own gallery there in Boston. And they were talking about this on the BBC News or NPR or something like that, and I just heard it out of the corner of my ear, so to speak, and of course, when I thought about artists in Boston, I couldn't help but think about Paul Laffoley. So I grabbed my telephone, I called Paul, and he picked up the phone, and I asked him if he'd be on the show at the beginning of the year. So I think we're going to ring in the new year with Paul Laffoley. We'll do a new year program with one of my favorite people around, Paul Laffoley, this amazing artist, architect, and just a visionary alchemist of sorts, who's now actually becoming much more of a prominent figure in those fields, even though he was very quiet and very shadow-like for some three decades. But my God, Paul Laffoley is just an amazing, amazing person, and we're going to ring in 2008 in high fashion with Mr. Paul Laffoley, and I'm thrilled. So that's the kind of stuff we'll be doing over the next few weeks and couple of months, and I think I've blabbered on long enough, and we'll play a song here by John Cale. This is a project of his. It's called Satellite Grooves. And The song is actually called Robotic Stutter. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Stick around. We got a great program tonight. We'll do a tribute and some words from Terrence McKenna in just a little while, okay? Mike Hagan, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Radio Orbit. Stutter. That's John Cale from Satellite Grooves. It's Mike, who listens to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. All right, quickly, a Thanksgiving Around the World celebration in Columbia will be presented by the Columbia Interfaith Council. This multicultural evening of words, music, song, and dance from around the globe will be on Tuesday, November 20th at Congregation Beth Shalom at 500 West Green Meadows Road. Bring a donation of non-perishable food if you can. More information at 573-874-1863. Also, there's usually a thing for Mark's show tomorrow night, evening edition, on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. And I don't see it tonight, but anyway, check out Mark's show on Tuesday evening, 6 p.m., evening edition. He talks about, well, issues that are probably of concern to you, perhaps. Okay, What else? Thanksgiving, yeah, just around the corner. So happy Thanksgiving to those of you who celebrate it. And, you know, it's always good to be thankful for stuff. I would, you know, maybe suggest thinking about the native people this year, the people that were here before we got here, and, you know, a little bit about the current situation that many of them might be in, just if you're thinking along those lines and not trying to preach or anything, but just, you know, it's a thankful time, and everyone should have something to be thankful for, and we certainly should be thankful for the land and the, you know, the space that we have, and it wasn't always ours. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and we are going to do a tribute to my friend Terrence McKenna tonight, okay? Before we do that, I want to make a couple of announcements. There's this comet that we've been following called P17 Holmes, and since October 24th, it has been acting strangely for a comet, and I just wanted to say that that is continuing. And if you want to follow the whole story, the best way to do that is to get on the website and click over there to Kent Stedman's site at cyberspaceorbit.com. He's done about the most comprehensive continuing analysis from all angles of what's happening with this thing up there in the stars above our heads. It's essentially between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter right now, but expanding. And I don't want to be alarmist about it, because it's not there's really nothing to be alarmed about, frankly, as far as I'm concerned right now. It's not like coming at us or anything, I don't think. But it's just a really interesting event. And from an astrophysical, you know, point of view, people in those circles are very excited and talking about, you know, all kinds of different things. And so even though it doesn't really make it down to the mainstream, and we're not hearing much about it in, you know, in the press, it really is an historical event, what's happening right now. And it's something that you can see here in North America pretty much from sundown until sunrise. You just have to know where to look. And it's a naked eye comet, certainly, if you're in areas where there's not a lot of light pollution. But even in the biggest of cities, with a pair of binoculars, this is a stunning astral event. So do yourself a favor, and you know, if you want to see something cool that you probably won't have a chance to see for a long time, get a pair of binoculars, go to Kent Stedman's site at cyberspaceorbit.com, and look at the map there, and you can find out where to look in the sky. Essentially, the comet is hanging around the constellation of Perseus, which is, well, from here in Missouri, as Orion rises, you'll see the constellation of Cassiopeia. And there's an M. You can actually make sort of an M out in the sky with some of the stars from Cassiopeia. And if you look up and to the left, at least the last time I looked, and I know the thing's moving around a little bit, you'll find in the constellation of Perseus this amazing comet. If you want, you know, specific details, go to Kent's site, and you'll be able to track the thing down pretty much to the, you know, arc second if you really want to. But it's not that hard to locate if you just do it sort of the way that I mentioned. It's the brightest thing in the sky up there with a pair of binoculars. So, anyway, amazing stuff going on in space. What else did I want to mention? Well, Carl Kalaman. Dr. Carl Kalaman was on the radio program on the 22nd of October. And for those unfamiliar, he's another one of these. There aren't many, and I shouldn't speak lightly about it, but he's a person who's a scholar, first of all, and a brilliant person, and an expert in the Mayan cosmology, the Mayan mythology, and the Mayan calendrical system, the way that they told time. And it had been quite some time between myself being introduced to Carl Kalaman and his material and the time that I actually had him on the program. And there was sort of a reason because of his particular perspective on this whole thing. Carl has believed that 2007, that this year, was a very pivotal sort of linchpin time in the Mayan calendar. And from my own experience and in my own life and from my own perspective, I've also had this intuition that this year was somehow more significant than those that have been preceding it in the last six, say, since 2001. And the whole 9/11 business. But anyway, Carl made it very clear on the program on the 22nd of October that the year 2007 on the Gregorian calendar wasn't over yet. In fact, we have 2 months left. And his implication was that, you know, between now and the end of the year, things are going to get interesting. And again, you know, I don't claim to be a prophet or a predictionist or anything like that. It's just my own intuition that this is the case. And so that's the main reason why I wanted to have Carl on when I did. And if you follow his work, you'll find out that today, the 19th of November, is the beginning of what's called the fifth night of the galactic underworld. And he spoke about this on the air back in October. We are now ending the fifth day, which began, I think, on the 19th of, or the 24th, actually, of November last year. And so we're now entering the fifth night. And there are certain things that are associated with these shifts, with these changes. And Carl's one of the men who has looked very deeply into this for a long, long time. I don't know. It's one of the main reasons why I'm interested in it. And we'll have to see what happens now, if anything significant, between now and the end of the year. But regardless, if you follow the Mayan cosmology, welcome to the fifth night. All right? Okay. What else? I don't want to talk about AIDS and HIV tonight. Status quo with that stuff. The silence is deafening. Space weather, go to Kent's site. You can check it out there. Everything happening in the stars above your heads being chronicled in tremendous fashion by Kent Stedman and has been for 10 or 11 years now. So I think what we'll do, I'll play one more piece of music here, and then we'll come back and we'll get going with some stuff from Terrence, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do for the rest of the program, okay? All right, what we'll do right now is listen to a song, I should say, from John Cale. And this was written with our good friend Terrence in mind, and we'll play it right now, and then we'll come back and hear the man himself, all right? It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is called Reclaim Your Mind, John Cale on Radio Orbit.
Being manufactured carried out of the bones of a dying world. Where is that at?
Exactly. Where is that at? It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. All right, for the remainder of the program, we'll be listening to a couple of excerpts from a series of lectures that were given by Terence McKenna in 1990 called History Ends in Green. Terence's knack for the spoken word is in full on display in this awesome series. It was recorded at Esalen, at California's Esalen Institute back in 1990. He presents an overview of some of his theories, including his ideas about evolution, ideas of humankind and our relationship with psychedelic plants. For those who have never taken a psychedelic substance or haven't had these experiences, or for those of you out there who would never even approve of such of a thing, I think you'll still find Terence interesting, and I think you might even find him amazing. I've introduced this man to so many people over the years from all kinds of different backgrounds, and if you give him 15 minutes, he tends to captivate most all. But regardless, he captivated me, and I, to this day, give Terence and his brother Dennis a tremendous amount of credit for helping me shape who I am and who I am still becoming. And Terence was the most remarkable person that I've ever known. And he was the greatest teacher that I've ever known. He was a tremendous spirit and a shaman of just the highest magnitude. And it was a pleasure and a privilege and an ongoing honor to be associated with him and his family. And I won't say any more. Here he is. His name is Terence Kemp McKenna. He was born on the 16th of November, 1946. This is from Mystic Fire Audio. It's called History Ends in Green. Aho, my brother.
I've been traveling a lot and speaking a lot to different kinds of people, and most recently in Europe. So I see that I've returned to the home congregation here. And because, you know, this seems to be the overwhelming focus of this group, which is interesting. It's even sometimes sort of confining to me, because I would wander maybe in other directions, but every prophet is the captive of his earliest ideological expression. You know, I mean, Lenin couldn't do much about Leninism once it had passed a certain point. So in hearing what people's interests were, trying to think about it in new ways, you know, the uniting thing in the 20th century, I think one of the things that sets the 20th century completely apart, really, from previous times, if not ontologically, then by degree, is the focus on the moving image and the role that this has had in shaping 20th century culture. And it comes really in three forms. It comes in the natural and available form of the dream, which always, to some degree, has shaped human culture. But for Freud and Jung in the early 20th century and their followers, the dream took on a whole new significance that it had never had before. It was seen as a cryptic messenger from a hidden world. And as these things seem to work out, concomitantly, a technology of the moving image was developing, which was film. And film and the dream then become almost the two defining poles of the evolution of the aesthetic of the 20th century over the first half of it, we'll say. And then in 1953, because that's when Gordon and Valentina Wasson discovered the mushroom, or earlier, if you want to date it to Hoffman's discoveries in Switzerland or the German work in the 20s, or later, if you want to date it to the discovery in 56 of DMT by Zara, But at any point, at any rate, at some point, the third triad is introduced, which is the hallucinogenic or psychedelic experience. And all three of these areas of concern have adumbrations in the primitive, the stress on dreaming, even the magic lantern and prestidigitation feats of Renaissance magic have a relationship to early film. And of course, the psychedelic experience is absolutely archaic. Nevertheless, the coming together of these three concerns in this particular fashion in the 20th century set the stage, I think, for an important part of what I will call during this weekend the archaic revival. And the archaic revival is nothing less than a strategy for cultural survival on a global scale. And it's a strategy that is taking place in the animal body of mankind. It's not an intellectual strategy or a rational strategy. This is what happens whenever a society is slammed to the wall. It unconsciously reaches back through its history or its mythology for a steadying metaphor. Now, the last time this happened in the West and worked was at the time of the collapse of the medieval Christian eschatology, at the time of the rise of urbanization and banking and secular society. The model of the Christian universe was no longer serviceable, and very suddenly philosophers, politicians, social planners reached into the past for classic models. And this was in the 15th and 16th century. And they created classicism, the revivification of Roman law, Greek architecture, Greek polity. All of this happened 1,000 to 1,500 years after these things had been completely abandoned. But then they became the basis for modern secular civilization, and our laws are Greco-Roman, and our architecture and our aesthetic and so forth and so on. Well, the way this is happening in the 20th century is, number one, at a much more deep and profound level, because it's a global reflex. The entirety of modern civilization has shot its wad in some sense. You know, from the perspective of 500 years, a society that cannot put bread on its grocery shelves, such as the Soviet Union, and a society such as our own that is $3 trillion in debt, the difference is negligible. I mean, both of these societies are functionally bankrupt. So we're living through, and have been living through throughout the 20th century, an experience of the dissolution of boundary and form. Everything has been in a state of flux throughout the 20th century. I mean, it opens with the concept of the Edwardian gentleman and lady firmly in place, class structure, class privilege, race privilege, sex privilege, the entire structure of the assumptions of the post-medieval world are in place and functioning. Now, 90 years later, none of this is in place. And to my mind, the major factor working to achieve this end has not been the two world wars or the exploration of the unconscious by Dada and surrealism or the breakdown of classical design mores or any of this stuff. It's been the psychedelic experience. The psychedelic experience is a genuine paradigm shattering phenomenon. We claim that we want this. This is what lies behind the love of flying saucers and you know, the Loch Ness Monster and all of this is we want a paradigm-shattering object, piece of evidence, body of testimony, something like that. But what we don't realize is we have it. We have it, as somebody over here on this side of the room said, you know, it's a matter of courage. And this places it in a special mode. It's not something where we can just validate it and then, found an institute and appoint experts and expect them to issue a report. It's something actually at the center of our being. And my motivation for talking to audiences like this is simply that I cannot conceive of mature human beings going from the cradle to the grave without ever finding out about this. I mean, it's not like not finding out about sex or something, you know? It's just too weird. It's a part of our birthright. It's not a cultural artifact. It's not like being able to ride a bicycle or something like that, where you can imagine that pygmies or Amazonian Indians go from birth to grave and they never ride a bicycle and they never miss it. But this is a little more existentially front and center than that. I mean, this is, as far as I can tell, the dimension in which we most fully experience ourselves as ourselves. Well, you know, culture, we have to be very careful about the corrosive effects of culture. Some of you may know about these, that was reported in Time magazine a month or two ago, about these forms of salamanders that never, if the conditions of alkalinity in the lakes are at a certain level, they never mature into the adult form. They actually can reproduce in a juvenile form. So there can be generations of these salamanders that don't even suspect the existence of an adult form that lies beyond the sexually mature functional adult form. And this is how I sort of think of what the effect of human culture has been on us. Starting about 15 or 20,000 years ago, for reasons that we'll discuss tomorrow, ego began to emerge as a factor in human societies. For the moment, let's just say it had to do with the concern for tracing male lines of paternity. In other words, once men had it enough together to understand the role that sexuality was playing in childbearing, then there became this concern to trace male lines of descent. And suddenly, sexuality had to be very carefully controlled, and the concept, my children, my women, my food, my territory, came into being. Before that, there was a kind of orgiastic, polymorphic sexuality that did not promote this kind of boundary formation at the edge of the body's effectiveness. You know, in other words, the ego was not a concept as rooted as it is in us. And I think that the shift from this boundaryless, group-oriented consciousness, which was psychedelic, to the egocentric, materialistic consciousness that typifies Western society, clear back to Sumer, that this is the neurotic wrong turning, and that when we look back into the causes of it, we can see and argue fairly persuasively that it has to do with an abandonment of the this relationship of ecstasy induced by plants, that there was almost a kind of symbiotic relationship between early human beings and plants, specifically psychedelic plants, and that this relationship is not something airy-fairy or unclear or operationally undefined for its participants. You get yourself lined up with and arranged correctly in relation to this thing by taking psychoactive plants. And that this is how human societies were regulated over, let's say, a million years. And there was nothing magical or untoward about it. It was simply that these evolving primates had a population regulatory mechanism that integrated them into the larger body of nature. And this is what has been lost in the historical process, so that human culture has become, charitably a random walk, uncharitably a kind of cancerous exponential cascade of unstoppable effects. Now, the thing is that we are in a position to understand this now, if not actually do something about it. H.G. Wells said, history is a race between education and catastrophe. Well, never more so than today, because the world is set on a course of catastrophe. The emotional constipation and rigidity of the past 1,000 years that has set us up as territorial apes with thermonuclear arsenals, all of that is just set to, go critical. Nevertheless, we are minded creatures in the presence of an evolving and rapidly shifting landscape of problems. And I think that it's a very hopeful sign to look around and notice that the only barrier to the solution of our problems are intellectual barriers, barriers in our own mind. We have the money, the technology, the mass communications, the scientific expertise, the remote sensing telemetry. What we don't have is the will to self-direct all of this technical apparatus toward a rational solution of our problems. But that means that the solution to our problems lies almost entirely in the human domain. And the human domain is the area where we observe the highest rate of unpredictable perturbation. So I don't see the situation as terminal or desperate at all. The mushroom's take on the chaos at the end of history is, this is what it's like when a species prepares to depart for the stars. It is chaotic, but it is not disordered. It is more like a birth than anything else. I mean, there is rending of tissue, there is a sense of crisis, of unstoppable forward motion, but it turns out all according to plan, all to good end. The trick is to somehow attain this vision of the ordered correctness of what is happening when it seems so chaotic, and then to template it, to strengthen it each for ourselves, and then to replicate it and communicate it as a meme, because there is no percentage in paralysis here at the brink. The only possibility is of some kind of forward escape. A forward escape is when you attain the goal by simply rushing through the gauntlet. And I think that this history that is a race between education and catastrophe is going to turn out to be a forward escape. There will be a moment of complete abandonment to the irrational. And we will look tomorrow at the time wave. We will look at Saddam Hussein and his role in all of this, But he is not the final act. This is somewhere late in Act One, all this malarkey that we're having to put up with. But Apnayant, which in this case means downstream in time, we will sprout all our worth and woof up.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. His name is Terrence McKenna. And my name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. I'm going to take a little break here at the top of the hour and play a piece of music from John Cale. Then we'll come back and continue with History Ends in Green from Terrence McKenna, okay? All right, it is just before midnight now on the 19th, approaching the 20th. Of November, and it is KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is John Cale. The song is called Bicyclette. We'll be right back. All right, John Cale, Bicyclette. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We're going to get right back to it here with Terrence McKenna and a lecture that he gave in 1990 at the Esalen Institute in California. And we will get back to that in just a moment here. I think this should do it here.
I guess I should say just a little bit about how I got into this. And I think curiosity is probably the ultimate value in my cosmology. It's what's gotten me anywhere I've ever been. It's the only impulse that I trust completely. And it's alive in most people as children, but it gets somehow squelched or misdirected or something. So when I look back through my own life, I see this psychedelic impulse before there was ever a word or a name for what it was. And I've tried to think back as far back as I can. And I have very early memories, like to the eighth month, but they don't seem to relate to this. But I remember I was born in 46, it must have been in late 48, I found a magazine of my father's, which I now must have been the October 1948 issue of Weird Tales. And it had these illustrations in it, and one of the illustrations was of a hooded figure gazing into a cradle. And I got this somehow as an image of the strange, the other, the outre. And I think this is the other thing that for me was the hook into the psychedelic, was a kind of deep Irish love of the weird from the very get-go. So curiosity and a love of the weird, the edgy, the bizarre. And this led me into, and I guess maybe a certain degree of obsessive character. I mean, I'm spending time on this because I'm trying to understand the psychedelic personality generally. But I did have a tendency to really focus in on whatever I was into. And I think the first thing was rocks. And this was, it was for me an introduction into the size of time, because it wasn't just any rocks that interested me. It quickly became clear that it was fossils. And I lived in Western Colorado, and I could go out into these dry arroyos and bring back datable objects, 170 million years old, and stack them up and look at them. So then I got this dizzying sense of the depth of time. And, there were those little museum pamphlets where it shows a billion years, and then the last million years is up here, and then it goes down here and spreads out, and then the last 10,000 years. I got that. I assimilated this notion of deep, deep time. And then, it was almost like an intellectual ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny, because the rocks, the inanimate mineral world, soon couldn't confine this restless imagination. So then it became about insects, butterflies specifically, moths especially, as an excuse to be alone in the middle of the night around bright lights, with cyanide. I don't know if any of you have ever been touched by this particular obsession, but because we're insectivores, because our food-getting habits are wired into a brain 50 million years old in the insect-gathering habit, you know, this is a very deep, almost orgasmic response that you can touch in the human organism. And I pursued it again and again in life, to the point where I did it as a professional in the jungles of Indonesia and the Amazon. And it's horrifying to tell in Buddhist company. But when you come upon one of these long-winged iridescent ornithopterids of the sort that Baron Guy de Rothschild sent his collectors out for in the late 19th century, and you come upon one of these things hanging under a leaf, looking for all the world like it weighs at least half a pound, and, you know, wrestle it into your net, it's as close to having a heart attack as I ever want to get. And then this thing, at some point, I did a lot of reading, and at some point I discovered that I had defined myself narrowly, and that I was turning into a scientist. And I was reading people like Henry James and Aldous Huxley, and they were sneering at what I was becoming and talking about a mysterious realm of human thought called the humanities, which I had no notion of what this was. I couldn't even figure out what it possibly could be. Well, then I discovered it meant music, painting, architecture, dance, philosophy, design, in short, the human world. The human world as opposed to the natural world. So then, you know, I just turned upon that with a vengeance, left off the bugs and the minerals, and it became about Henry James and Fragonard and mannerism and all of this stuff. But the transition, because I was hitting adolescence at that point, was rocketry. And the pineal joy of launching potentially semi-fatal projectiles into space at twice the speed of sound, into, you know, a whole gravity's rainbow cycle that I was very consciously aware was about the thrill of liftoff. All this tormenting of mice and cutting up of aluminum chaff into stuff to be dumped out at the top of the trajectory was just to satisfy physics teachers and anxious parents and all that. And the real thing was, this amazing moment of launch when this potassium perchlorate and sugar fuels would just propel these things with ear-splitting intensity. And then at that point, all this curiosity, all this edge work led me, because I fancied myself also developing as a novelist, to read all of Aldous Huxley. Well, as you know, it moves from a spectrum of these polite novels of English society, like Chrome Yellow and Antic Hay, and through works like After Many a Summer Dies the Swan, to then the sexual dystopia of Brave New World, and then finally to The Doors of Perception. And when I read The Doors of Perception, I knew then that this was something huge. Because he was claiming, you see, what was happening to me as an intellectual, and I think it happens to most people, is exploration of reality was leading to the conclusion that it was a no-exit situation. It was some kind of rational labyrinth from which there was no exit. No exit meaning no magic, no possibility of a miracle, that, you know, there weren't 25,000-year-old cities under the sands of Arabia. There weren't flying saucers underneath the Greenland ice cap. It didn't work for me. For me, rationalism was more powerful than sort of menopausal fantasy as it's currently practiced. And so it was drying up. The miraculous was just turning into ordinary reality. And then I discovered psychedelic plants. And it was like the descent of an angel into a desert of reason. Because, that's an interesting sort of metaphor, the descent of an angel into the desert of reason. As you probably know, when Descartes was 21 years old, he shipped out in a Habsburgian army to kick some ass in Eastern Europe and learn some manly soldiering skills. And he was in Ulm in southern Germany in August of 1620, Ulm later to be the birthplace of Einstein. And Descartes, who was completely wet behind the ears, didn't know anything, had a dream. And in the dream, an angel, this is apropos of the metaphor, an angel appeared to him and said, "The mastery of nature is to be achieved through measure and number." So what's interesting about that then is that he went on to found modern science, which was to be the very temple of rationalism and reason, but it was based on the revelation of an angelic being who spoke to him from another dimension. Well, this was the kind of impact that the psychedelic experience had for me. It was as though there was a doorway, a literal doorway, out of the completely otherwise flawless set of cultural assumptions that kept me, you know, a Catholic altar boy in a small Colorado town in a Western democracy in a context of anti-communism, religious fundamentalism, consumer capitalism, so forth and so on. The whole bag of tricks and illusions were suddenly exposed for that. And beyond that, you see, like that traveler sticking their head out through the world system and seeing a whole different set of rotations and revolutions, you see another dimension of some sort. And then for me, the question became, you know, of what sort? What is this? Number one, what is it? Number two, how did they manage to keep the lid on it? And number three, what can you do with it? Well, coincidentally upon all this, or let's call it coincidental, society was just going bananas around somewhat similar issues, because I was born in 1946, so that means in 1966 I was 20 years old, and somehow fate had conspired to put me in Berkeley, California. So I happened to be at like the ground zero of the cultural explosion. But I had been following all this stuff for years. It just seemed to me a weird parallelism that my internal growth and obsessions were now somehow becoming the obsessions of society generally. Being 20 years old, I just thought it was a kind of vindication. You know, I knew I'd been right since I was 16, so here was the payoff. But then, you know, it didn't exactly work out like that. These concerns moved through society like a wave. And then other stronger, what the I Ching calls prepotent systems of arrangement, reasserted themselves. And instead of a kind of psychedelic utopia, there was a kind of anti-psychedelic dystopia. And everything that psychedelics had tended to call into question, which were the great sins of the 20th century, the misuse of propaganda, the abuse of imagery, the distortion of information. And these are all uniquely modern, new sins, if you will. And I talked last night a little bit about the connection between dreams, the unique province of 20th century psychological theory, film and the psychedelics. All of these things, and I see it also active in art, that as soon as you move beyond Impressionism, the whole history of art in the 20th century is about the dissolution, deconstruction, and attempt to reconstruct the image. So that, you know, movements as different as analytical cubism and abstract expressionism all are seen to be struggling with the dissolution and reemergence of the image. Well, what it means is, what all this constellation of cultural effects is saying is that the previously assumed to be existentially prepotent order of society, of linear society, is actually an illusion, and that we can move beyond it. We can dissolve it. Not only we cannot not do this. So then the goal becomes, and this is where McLuhan is important, to try and raise into consciousness the process that we are undergoing before it is a fait accompli, before we are in the act of looking back then at a historical event. Because I'm convinced that the impulse that I feel in myself and that I see in other people toward the psychedelic experience has to do with its potential historical impact. Even though, God knows, we're all aware this is how religion has always been practiced, you know, yet somehow this million-year-old sociological phenomenon, orgiastic, group-minded shamanism in a context of nomadic pastoralism, this phenomenon was only interrupted 10 or 15,000 years ago. And is apparently the state of dynamic equilibrium where we function at our best, where we feel at our most human. What has happened to us is a kind of false bottom in our social dynamic. It's a series of self-reinforcing situations of dis-ease. It begins with what I talked about last night about concern for male paternity. That once men wanted to trace the descent line of the male genes, previously self-expressive, orgiastic, group-minded sexuality became compartmentalized into concerns of territoriality, ownership, so forth and so on. But then that wasn't the end of it. There then the rise of hierarchical kingship, the amazing, you see, the problem with human beings is that we ride very close to a kind of bifurcation point in terms of whether our loyalty is transferred to the group or to the individual. And this can be sent either way. I mean, if there were to be landslides at both ends of Highway 1 and a food shortage, you know, we would coalesce marvelously into a survival machine where we would all place group values higher than our own needs. And nobly so, this would happen. But in situations of abundance and non-scarcity, then it's like a slime mold without the formality of coherency. We just then dissolve into this sort of every man for himself, egocentric style. And then, you know, another bad break along the way that may or may not have been fated, may have just been a bad break, is the evolution of the phonetic alphabet, which creates a tremendous distance between cognition and the objects of linguistic intentionality. And this gives permission then for all kinds of forms of brutalization. It actually gives permission for ideology. ideology, to my mind, is the denial of the obvious and the substitution for something else. Where you say, you know, no, that's not how people are. We have a Marxist model, or we have a Freudian model, or we have, you know, John Stuart Mill's model. Who knows? But somebody's model. So ideology, someone said language was invented in order that people could lie. And in large measure, this is true, that we proceed by deception. I'll defend this at some point in this weekend, because another word for it is modeling. You know, we model, but we also fall in love with these models. And it's the falling in love with the model that then turns it into an agenda, where it was not a free-form projection of a flow of facts toward the conclusion, but then it becomes instead an agenda, a synthetic creode, high walls down which you expect to see a process poured and confined. So, okay. So in spite of the fact that this phenomenon has been around for a long time, why then does it appear so important? Well, it's because this small group, group-minded, sexually amorphous psychology, the psychology, not the model itself, is what we have to recover, I think, in order to survive. And, I'm not so interested in talking about the odds of making it. It's just, this is the only thing that will work. And I said last night, you know, the good news is that the domain in which we must operate is all within our own minds. You know, if we can change our minds, we can take hold of this process and halt it. I believe that the presence of these psychedelics in the plant metabolism, in the biosphere, allowed a kind of informational symbiosis between human beings with highly processing capacity and the biosphere generally, and that we have no word for this that we're comfortable with. The closest word we have for it is somehow tied up with the concept of religion, religio. But for us, religion is some kind of abstract dialogue carried on with a philosophical principle. That's not what it is. Religion, originally, was the dimension of the self that directly interfaced nature, or the over-self. And this happened through the use of psychedelics. So the reason the weekend is called History Ends in Green, and what this whole Gaian awareness thing is, to my mind, is it's not an airy-fairy attempt to recast a new image for religious ontology. It's the actual discovery of the minded presence of the planet, which has always been here, which is real. It's an existential fact, like chlorophyll or, the moons of Saturn. The planet has a biological mind of some sort. Once you articulate this notion, it doesn't seem that unlikely. After all, the planet is clearly a boundary-defining topology. It's had the 2 billion years to make itself metastable, undergo all kinds of autopoiesis. We see the evidence of this around us in the form of the climaxed biome of the planet. We see that biology and water chemistry has been very active. But what we don't see is that as active as the chemistry of water or electron transfer have also been the invisible alchemies of, you know, call it spirit, call it mind, call it the morphogenetic field, whatever it is. And that is the frontier of our awareness. every society in history has had the erroneous belief that it just required 6 more months and 5% more data, and then they would have a full picture of reality. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, our society at its present state of sophistication, we have the only science we have that can be given any serious credibility at all is physics, the most primitive of all sciences, the science of momentum and moving bodies in three-dimensional space. When you move on to biology, you know, essentially what we have are a series of interlocking fables and a few bright spots of light in certain areas. When you move on to psychology, what you have is shouting charlatans, you know, each claiming domain over their own special area. I mean, it's like a medieval fair. So the belief that our intellectual maps are somehow adequate is just whistling past the graveyard. And the way we have achieved this illusion of good maps is by tossing out all the disturbing and unintegratable phenomena. For instance, dreams were trivialized and ignored for centuries. Madness was something that you can find a way, like criminality, was not to be looked at. Sexuality, I don't have to remind you that as recently as 120 years ago, people were putting bloomers on piano legs to preserve youth from impure thoughts. I mean, you talk about a rejectionist style toward reality. I mean, we have just begun to open our eyes to what is around us. Well, so then front and center, when we begin to explore, let's take a conservative position toward exploring the universe. Let's explore from the center outward. Well, that means from within the confines of the mind-body system. Before we generalize about tectonic plates or the motion of the rings of Uranus or something like that, just start from the body up. Well, immediately you discover total terra incognita. Psychology gives us a flickering model of ordinary consciousness under ordinary circumstances, and everything else is up for grabs. And then we discover that, you know, at the center of human concerns is this weird itch about invisible worlds and higher order entities and sources of hidden knowledge. And we've discovered that people have been at that for 100,000 years, and the centerpiece technique, which is to trigger these non-ordinary states of consciousness, with all our sophistication, we have no better grip on what this is than people in the late Neolithic. They knew more than we did, because they'd logged more time on in the real modality. I mean, we have models. We say, you know, the drug molecule is translocating to the synapse and displacing ordinary neurotransmitters and raising, therefore, the endogenous level of electron spin resonance. This is not any kind of explanation about what's going on. This is just the chant, the incantation, you know, that the people who are logging time in there, they come back with maps of reality that fit very uneasily with our cheerful Cartesian, Democritean, atomistic, causal, entropic models. And they say, no, the universe is an infinite honeycomb, each honeycomb ruled over by different spiritual forces, each commanded through different languages, magical techniques, gestural repertoire. Everything is language. Everything holds information for man. Everything is somehow constellated on the presence of observing mind. Well, in the West, we thought we got cosmogonic myths with the Ptolemaic universe, you know, even before Copernicus. But now it turns out that the centrality of mind gets reintroduced. not only by the evidence of the psychedelic experience, but for instance, the school philosophy of science around L.L. White and people like that have pointed out that if you use as your index complexity, then you suddenly discover that human beings have moved back to the very center of the universe, that the most complex physical material in the universe in terms of density of connectedness is the human cerebral cortex. That if novelty and density of connectedness is what is being conserved, then somehow we are central. Well, so then, you know, other issues are raised. If we are central, then the modern model of history, which is, I don't know if it's ever been explicitly stated for you, but the modern model of history is that it is trendlessly fluctuating. This is the largest structure in which we find ourselves embedded, call it the last 10,000 years, and the best guess of the people who spend the most time looking at it is that it trendlessly fluctuates. That means it's like a drunk on a wandering walk. You see that processes are channeled toward conclusions. That in the evolutionary, well, leave that aside for a minute, in the realm of physical chemistry, you see that the progressive cooling of the universe allowed more and more complex chemistry. First, electrons could settle down into stable orbits around atomic nuclei. Then molecular bonds could form. At still lower temperatures, polymerization could form, and therefore templating-type molecules like DNA. The universe seems to be an engine for the conservation of complexity until we reach the social sciences, where they want to tell us that history is just dropped into this process willy-nilly, is not fractally modeled on anything that precedes it, does not express an internal coherence, and is a completely trendless process. Yet notice that this completely trendless process is atomically composed of the most complex matter, material organization in the universe, the human cerebral cortex.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike, and it is about 25 minutes or so before the hour of 1 a.m. now on the 20th of November, 2007. We're listening to Terence McKenna from a series of lectures in 1990 at Esalen Institute in California called History Ends in Green. We'll return to that in just a couple minutes here, okay? In the meantime, take a break, go get a drink, or use the restroom, or whatever you need to do, and listen to a little bit of John Cale. The song is called Turn to Light, Time to Flow. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Thank you. John Cale. That's Turn to Light, Time to Flow. Wonderful stuff. Thank you, John, for the wonderful music. You can find information about John and download some of this great stuff on his website at johncale.com. And he's also a very talented visual artist and a writer and just someone I'm glad to be in touch with and have the opportunity to share some of his music with you all tonight. Okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 1:42 in the a.m. on the 20th of November now, the first day of the fifth night, if you know what I mean. We're going to get right back to Terrence McKenna from History Ends in Green. Check this out.
Well, I mention this because part of what I'm interested in with this weekend is trying to get a handle on, you know, what is history? What does it mean? It began only 1,500 generations ago, which if we were fruit flies would be 3 weeks ago. So, you know, it's not something really basic to human beings, but it's a process that got started about 1,500 generations ago, and it's a clearly a cumulative runaway process. It's going on outside the realm of ordinary genetics. Ordinary genetic change is very conservative and slow. This is a cancerous type process, but in the cultural domain, it's an epigenetic process, meaning it's not scripted in the genes, but like writing and TV and painting, it goes on outside of the genes. Well, where does it go on? Well, it goes on in the domain of language. And to my mind, language is the critical area to focus on in terms of where the psychedelics are operating and how, if our interest is to trap them doing their elfin work, then the place to look is in the domain of language. Why? Well, first of all, look at what language is. It's a weird kind of ancillary add-on process to the human organism. No other monkeys do it in quite the same way. And I don't argue that there is not linguistic and grammatical activity in monkeys, dolphins, termites, what have you, but it's very different from what goes on in human beings. Obviously, for instance, you probably know that the soft palate of the human being drops lower in the fetal form than in any other primate by 40% or something. What this, the embryological interpretation of this is that the human animal is hardwired for language. And if you notice what it is, it's small mouth noises. Rapidly modulated small mouth noises. And it's a conventionalized, it's a highly conventionalized style of behavior which allows transduction of thought. It's a form of telepathy, a striving toward a crude telepathy. Because if you analyze what's happening in the linguistic act, it's that we've all gotten together and we agree that there are these small mouth noises, and we agree that a given set of small mouth noises means a certain thing. And we spent so much time together and so conventionalized our responses to each other that your dictionary of small mouth noises is theoretically supposed to match my dictionary of small mouth noises. So the words going through the air impinge upon your ear. You make a rapid search of your dictionary, and you come up with what you assume is a one-to-one match. And we rarely get together to check out just exactly how good a match it was. Occasionally someone will ask a question, and we will see that they understood that the match, and so the match was good. Because I see a lot of transcripts of my talks, I know that typists hear the most amazing things, and without ever questioning what they hear, they type these things that when I read them, you know, they're complete malapropisms. But this is what was heard. And as the level of discourse rises or the density of the technical language increases, it becomes much, much shakier. I mean, I just had the experience of lecturing in Czechoslovakia, in Prague, for the Film Academy. And, you know, you can go a long ways on sincerity, but there's a long ways still to go. Just nodding and smiling doesn't do it. Especially when the concepts are fine-tuned, and it's where they're fine-tuned, that they're always interesting. It's in the nuances of it. Well, I think probably that this activity was originally stimulated by the use of psychedelics, that in fact most of what is human about us has to do with our the presence of psychedelic and mutagenic compounds in our diet when we made the transition from being fruitarian, vegetarian, arboreal tree dwellers to becoming, nomadic pastoralists. If you think about it, you can see how this would work quite neatly. The reason animals specialize their diets is to hold down the amount of exposure to mutagenic chemicals. So most animals have highly specialized diets. That's because then they can develop pathways to sequester mutagens or to just avoid the exposure to them initially. But if you put pressure on an animal, on its original food source, where it's actually facing a situation of possible extinction or dietary transformation, it will begin experimenting, expanding its repertoire of foods. Well, this brings exposure to mutagens in a very steep curve, and this means consequently more expression of mutagenic genes become available for natural selection. And so this is the situation in which you might then see a sudden punctuated movement forward in the adaptive evolution of adaptive traits of the organism. But how this worked in the early human situation was drying up of the African continent forced protozoal types onto the grassland, where they began foraging for and insects had been part of their diet in the canopy situation. They began foraging. It's also thought they began perhaps predating on carrion kills, killed by larger carnivores like lions. In any case, they began forming a relationship that had them following along behind these evolving ungulate herds of mammals on the African belt. And in that situation, they encountered the coprophytic mushrooms, the mushrooms which grow in cow dung preferentially. And many of these contain psilocybin. Well, psilocybin, once encountered in the diet, acts very quickly to outbreed non-psilocybin-using individuals because, like many indoles, if there's a small amount of psilocybin in the diet, visual acuity is measurably increased. And Roland Fisher did work on this in the early 60s. Well, you can see that if an animal that is living by predation, and also it's thought by the the people who disagree with this theory, the people who do not think that mushrooms played a major role in human evolution, believe that the throwing arm is the unique human capability, and that when you see a pitcher get a ball across a plate, what is it to, how far is it from the pitcher's mound to the plate? 60 feet. That kind of control on an object hurled at that speed, no other animal can do anything even approaching that. And that this hand-eye coordination gave us our leg up literally, or our arm up, to be able to knock out large animals at a distance. Well, even if you believe that theory, you see it too depends on a very close coordination of hand and eye. Well, if you bring into this a chemical factor in the diet, which increases visual acuity, animals that are allowing this item in the diet will very quickly outbreed the non-mushroom users. And I submit that this happened, then further accelerating the tendency toward preferential use of mushrooms is the fact that at higher doses, but still sub-psychedelic doses, these same mushrooms will trigger arousal, general CNS, central nervous system arousal. But this also includes then sexual arousal and erection in males. Well, so what does this mean? It means that it's a party drug at that dose. It means that there is this impetus to copulation in a situation in which the better hunters have been more successful at getting food, so this increased copulatory activity and subsequent increased number of births is happening in an environment with an increased food supply. So you see, all these factors are converging to outbreed the non-mushroom using individuals. Well, then the final culminating factor in this is at yet higher doses, the mushroom ushers into the boundary dissolving ecstasy that we call the psychedelic experience, and that in that kind of a social small group situation would have led, I think, to primitive religious observance, ritual, group sexuality, food sharing, mate sharing, so forth and so on. And I really believe that this lifestyle, if you will, of nomadic pastoralism, goddess-oriented religion driven by psychedelic indoles in the diet, that for 50,000, approaching 75,000 years, this is how people lived. And they were fully realized people. I mean, there was tremendous oral poetry, epic works of art and theater, a complete realization of human potential in the dynamic context of this nomadic relationship to nature. I mean, this was Eden. This was when we were at peace with our humanness. Well, then, you know, what happened? Is there a search for scapegoats? Who's to blame? And the answer is nobody is to blame. The very process which brought this paradise into being, which was the drying up of the African continent and the forcing of our proto-human ancestors onto the veldt and into the bipedal, nomadic, tribal, language-using mode, the very forces which created that destroyed it, because eventually the great grasslands of the Sahara, the huge water holes, the vast herds of game gave way to encroaching dunes, shrinking water holes. The mushroom festivals, which I imagine at one point were probably lunar festivals, became then yearly festivals because of scarcity of the mushroom. And there became then anxiety about availability of mushrooms, and therefore a certain cultural pressure to find methods of preserving them. And this need turned naturally to the preserving powers of honey. And so there was a transitional phase of not fresh mushroom festivals, but preserved mushrooms in honey. The problem is, honey itself has the capacity to turn into a psychotropic substance. Through fermentation, it becomes mead. But the imprinting that takes place in a mead culture, mead cultures are cultures of male dominance, repression of female sexuality, hierarchy, warfare, wheel chariots, the whole shtick. And so You know, there was, and this all happened over thousands of years, this very gradual transition. There was never a conscious moment of tragedy. But you see, what was happening was a new psychic function was taking hold in the human animal. In the situation of the monthly boundary-dissolving group mushroom festivals, ego was not allowed to form. And I really view psilocybin as almost an inoculation against the formation of ego. It is a, it is an egolytic compound. So notions of male dominance, of possession of property, children, domesticated animals, or women, none of this went on in this situation where the boundary dissolution was reinforced by frequent mushroom use. But as soon as the mushrooms become less available, this thing begins to grow in the human personality, literally like a cancer or a tumor. It's a calcareous growth on the psyche that if we do not have this embeddedness in the vegetable matrix of Gaia, then anxiety arises, a lot of it sexual and related to self-identity, and I don't have to discuss this with you, just refer you to Freud and the whole gang. Everybody understands how bent we are. The question is why, and I think this is why, because we have been in a permanent state of neurotic disequilibrium for 15,000 years. And every move to attempt to correct this has pushed us further away from the goal that we want to have. So now we arrive at the late 20th century, nuclear arsenals fully in hand. We have made, since the 15th century, a demonic pact with matter that has allowed us great insight into the destructive properties of matter, made us, you know, handmaiden to the devil, and yet we are still completely dark about our own motivations, how to educate our children, how to put in place a set of values that don't loot the future. And all of these problems appear to be getting worse. So, you know, I don't know. Well, my response to this is to advocate the only thing that I think will work, but it's not a political position, because a political position always implies willingness to compromise and negotiate with the other side. And there really is no willingness to negotiate on the part of the psychedelic position, because it's pretty non-negotiable. We're at the end of a process, call it 2,000, 5,000, you know, choose your date, but a long process of denial of human nature first, and then war against human nature. And it goes so deep into our culture that we don't even know where the basement level is. I mean, for instance, to my mind, monotheism, which is the great intellectual edifice of the West, it touches the three major religions of the West that have developed in a continuous strain since Abraham. Monotheism is the institutionalizing of this egocentric model. And it has a certain philosophical appeal in one God, you know, everything, all roads lead to Rome. You can trace everything back to the Ur source, the Urquelle. But that anal retentive appeal in itself takes place within a context of values of male dominance, print-created linearity, uniformity, so forth and so on. And I think what we have to get into is real permission for sloppiness, for loose-endedness, for the abandonment of any myth of closure, that there is no closure. There are models and there are questions, but all models are provisional. And anybody who says they have answers is highly, highly suspect. Too many people claim answers. What's being claimed here is a technique, and then you figure out your own questions and your own answers, and it's different for everybody. There really is no ideology associated with psychedelics. I mean, if you look at the people who've been involved with it, they've said completely different things and contradictory. And some are rationalists and behaviorists to this day, and others are, you know, spiritual visionaries, hierarchical, shamanic types. The main thing is to reclaim the experience as the first step toward being politically empowered in order to act. In other words, we're in, and I indicated this last night, although more gently, that we're in a state of enforced infantilism about the capacity of our minds, that the culture we are living in is an infantile culture. Now, we look back at the Victorians putting pants on the piano legs, and we just shake our heads and say, you know, those poor misguided people. Well, but that's only four generations ago. We have similar weirdness going on in our own culture, but about the mind. I mean, we look askance at the mind the same way that a Victorian nanny is uncomfortable in the presence of bare furniture. We fear it. We don't want to look at it. And to my mind, most of the techniques that come out of the New Age are based on a guaranteed lack of success. That's what they offer. Because the last thing anybody wants is real change. Because real change is uncontrolled change. The issue that hovers around the psychedelic experience, it was mentioned last night, it's strong in my life. I haven't found any real solution other than hold your nose and jump. But the issue is surrender. This is something real. You don't find people going into the ashram in the morning to meditate with their knees knocking in fear because of how terrifying and profound they know that meditation is going to be. But if they were going in there to smoke DMT, you know, they would be fully riveted on the modalities of what was about to happen. I mean, we can tell shit from Shinola. It's just that we don't always prefer Shinola. And I'm not like, I don't advocate it. You know, people, like sometimes there are people who are disappointed because they say, well, how often do you do it? Well, the answer is not very often. I mean, if I can get it in a couple or three times a year, I feel like I'm hitting it pretty hard. And the more successful it is, the less often you have to do it. I mean, I know people who say DMT is their most favorite drug. And when you say, well, when was the last time you did it? They say, well, 1967. It only lasted 4 minutes. They're still processing it. And they are still processing it. They're not just whistling Dixie. I mean, it is, to my mind, well, I mentioned this earlier, the question, how do they keep the lid on this stuff? And I suppose here I'm preaching to the converted, because many people last night said they had an interest in this kind of thing. But they don't keep the lid on sexuality. No society has ever had it so under control that people didn't have sex. I mean, they may have had sex under weird conditions and under, you know, ritual strictures and this and that. But we are like this salamander that has the option of never developing into its mature form. And to my mind, that's a tragedy because this is our birthright, and somehow our inability to get a grip on our global problems has to do with this immaturity about our mental state. The two, I feel very strongly, are linked. And that, of course, we can't get control of the world because we are children in some profound way. And we don't like being children, but the culture has reinforced a form of infantilism. And the way I explain it to myself is it's a kind of unwillingness to go it alone on a certain level. I don't know how many of you remember in Brave New World, Huxley's brilliant dystopia, but there's a scene in there where Bernard, who is the guy who's out of it in the novel, because in his fetal fluid they got an alcohol contaminant, and so he's different from everybody else in this society, and he occasionally has original thoughts. And he and his assigned girlfriend for the evening, or whatever she is, are in a helicopter, and they sweep out past the crematoria where they're recollecting elements for reuse, and he suspends the helicopter over the Black Bay, and she immediately becomes very agitated, restless, anxious, and pleads with him to return to the city. And what it is it's her anxiety over being alone in the presence of nature. She literally can't take it. And I think there are a lot of people in our society, and each of us in our own way at different times, who have within us this neurotic and infantile creature that can't face it alone, and that this going it alone thing is very important. You know, Plotinus, the great Neoplatonic philosopher, he spoke of the mystical experience as the flight of the alone to the alone. And in the psychedelic experience, there is this issue of surrender, because a lot of people want to diddle with it. They want to be able to say they did it, but they don't ever want to face an actual moment where they put it all on the line. And yet the whole issue with this stuff is to let it lead, to let it show what it wants to show. So somehow, individually, we have to reclaim our experience. The real message, more important even than the psychedelic experience, the real message that I try to leave with people in these weekends is the primacy of direct experience. That as people, the real universe is, within your reach, always. Everything not within your reach is basically unconfirmed rumor. And we insert ourselves like ants or honeybees into hierarchies of knowledge. So we say, well, what's going on in the world? Well, turn on CNN, you know? And then somehow we're ordered then to say, it's 85 degrees in Baghdad and the wind is out of the northeast at 15 miles an hour. And we feel somehow better now because we're getting the information. But what we have done is sold out direct experience. And all institutions require this of us, that we somehow redefine ourselves for the convenience of the institution. And this redefinition always involves a narrowing, a denial. So that, you know, if you want to be in Marxist society, if you want to function in Marxist society, you have to define yourself as a Marxist human being. Well, it turns out in a Marxist society there are no homosexuals, because that just happens in decadent societies. So then, you know, if you happen to notice any tendency like this in yourself, you have to deny its existence, because this just doesn't happen in a Marxist society. And similarly, every society has this. In our society, if you hear voices, we have mental hospitals for you. If you have vast visions of the future, we have drugs that can help you and make this go away. So then somehow, in modern society, the discovery of psychedelics is the discovery that all of this cultural machinery is just Wizard of Oz stuff. You remember the scene in the Wizard of Oz where the curtain is swept back and they see the little guy there and he says, booming out over the loudspeaker, "Ignore the little man pulling the levers. Ignore the little man pulling the levers." Well, the little man pulling the levers is what sweeps into view with psychedelics, and you discover, aha, culture is provisional. You know, whether we have nine wives or three, whether we tattoo ourselves blue, whether we eat insects or not, all of these things are just decisions that we make, and then we congratulate ourselves on our wisdom, and we live within that, and we hunt down and kill all the people who disagree with us, and that's called having a culture, having a way of life, being somebody. You know, I don't see history as a wrong turning. I see it, the metaphor that I like is that of the prodigal son, that there was a reason for this long descent into matter, this peregrination. It was a shamanic journey of some sort. You know, the shaman goes into the whirlpool or ascends the world tree to go to the center of the axis of the cosmos to recover the pearl or the gift or the lost soul, and then return with it. And this is what history was, I think. It was a descent into the hell worlds of matter, energy, space, and time for the purpose of recovering something that was lost. It wasn't lost by us. It was lost by the breathing, the diastole of the planet. Just climax of climate moved us into paradise, and then moved us out of paradise. I mean, you might think the story of Eden is the story of history's first drug bust. I mean, it's the story of a whole lot of tension over who's going to take or not take a certain plant which confers knowledge. And Yahweh, wandering in the garden, says to himself, if the man and the woman eat of the fruit, they will become as we are. The issue was co-equality, co-knowledge with the Creator. Well, where do we stand, you know, in man's existential march? How does that work? Can we always accept the subservient, infantile position? I mean, is knowledge to be dispensed by gods, and if not gods, then the institutions that appoint themselves as gods over us? Or is it actually that maturity begins with somehow claiming this birthright? And it is a birthright. And I don't know if a society can survive the claiming of this birthright by a large number of people. Certainly in the 1960s, when this was attempted, everybody got very agitated, and then it was frozen out. In so-called primitive or pre-literate societies, there is the office of the shaman, and the shaman is deputized to act for all of us. In the same way that we have airplane mechanics to fix jet engines, we have shamans to explore these hidden and fairly terrifying other dimensions. The people who self-select themselves into a group like this, in a society like that, would be the candidates for this kind of shamanic voyaging.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 1:15 in the AM hours now in November the 20th, actually, and we're listening to a recorded lecture from Terence Kemp McKenna from 1990. Believe it or not, 17 years ago, this was recorded. It gives you a feel for how ahead of his time Terence actually was. I think if I didn't mention that it was 17 years ago that this was recorded, you probably wouldn't have known. It could have been recorded yesterday, frankly, down to the temperature in Baghdad, if you didn't notice that. But at any rate, it is a wonderful piece of Terence's heart and soul and mind, and I'm sharing it with you tonight. I hope you enjoy it. Terence was born on the 16th of November, 1946, and we're doing sort of a birthday thing for him tonight. So to my brother, Terence McKenna, happy birthday, and I hope you're sitting in somehow, listening in. We'll play a song here by John Cale, and then we'll come back and do a little bit more for Terence, all right? This one is called Kyrie, and you're listening to it on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Thank you. That's John Cale, and the song is called Kyrie. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We're going to get right back now to Terrence McKenna, History Ends in Green.
Well, so then what is it finally all for? Or is it for anything? Is it just maybe my problem that I think it's for something? Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, see, we have real problems. We could perish from this planet in some kind of radioactive petroleum war or what have you. And it wouldn't change the fact that shamanism did exist, that these dimensions were there and were explored by courageous, high-minded people for thousands of years. But I think that the scientific mind, and maybe even the American mind, can bring something special to it, that somehow technology has a role to play. And I think maybe what this has to do with is, I've talked a bit in the past, a lot in the past, about what I call visible language. Visible language is something that I encountered in psychedelic states. Could never have dreamed it up by myself. Encountered it as an existential fact. Then had to sort of reason backward from it to what would it be good for. Well, what is it? What is visible language? Well, it's very simply, it's language which you look at rather than hear. And don't ask me how this can happen. It obviously has something to do with synesthesias in the brain, with swapping neural processing units and somehow shunting a stream of data which would normally be audially interpreted. Instead, it goes to the visual cortex. And this occurs often in DMT intoxication, and it has a long and noble history in the Amazon in ayahuasca shamanism. Ayahuasca, as you probably know, is a combinatory drug made of a vine combined with the leaves of another plant, and it makes DMT orally active. Normally DMT is destroyed in the gut, but you take it in combo with this other thing, beta-carboline, and then it's active. Well, in the Amazon, these people sing what they call ícaros, magical songs, and these magical songs are given to them by the spirits, whatever those are, invisible entities. But the magical songs are invariably criticized pictorially and sculpturally rather than musically. Nobody ever talks about how these things sound. People only talk about how they look. And I had read about this and heard about it and went down there and spent time, again, curiosity is the only method, poking around. Finally got somebody who knew how to brew this stuff to make this happen. And, you know, I had seen it before on DMT, but on DMT it's somewhat out of control. It's as though your entire syntactical engine has sprung out of your chest and is rattling around on the floor in front of you. Well, first of all, notice language, ordinary language, what a weird thing it is, and yet we do it with such facility. We almost all of us can do it. It's a very severe impairment on your humanness if you are language deficient in any very serious way. Blindness is as nothing to being seriously language deficient, so forth and so on. So it's really the defining thing for us. And yet, you know, it's almost like a half miracle. I mean, you can study it. There's no problem with getting vast samples of it, tape recordings. We can analyze it syntactically. There have been many theories of syntax, philosophies of syntax. And yet, what is it? How can we make meaning with such facility when the rest of nature seems totally unconcerned with this? And what is meaning anyway? why is it so important to us? We say if there is no meaning, if life has no meaning, it's not worth living. Well, how do ants and bees and scallops stack up on that opinion? Do they also feel that meaning is the quintessential aspect of reality? And yet we make it. We make it out of ourselves. And then we get together with somebody else and we try to make meaning. We say, you know, you and I could have an affair, or you and I could start a business. This will have a lot of meaning for us. And, you know, we'll make money and buy more meaning. whatever it is, and C.B. Broad wrote a book called The Meaning of Meaning, which deals with it in about 400 pages. But whatever it is, it's very important to us, and it seems to have different modalities. For instance, dance can have meaning. Painting can have meaning. Spoken or textual words have meaning. But because of biases in ourselves as an organism, what seems to have the most meaning is what we can see. Our visual, we have a tremendously rich sense of visual input. Well, for some reason, under the influence of these psychedelic drugs and certain exercises, and who knows what else it takes to shake you out of your cage, that suddenly syntactical organization, which has been invisible in the background of the program of meaning, becomes visible. And you actually see the engines of syntax. You actually behold the machinery of meaning itself. And for some reason, this is very satisfying. It's like an ecstasy. It's like an affirmation of some sort that is transcendental. There is a recognition in it that transcends the felt apperception of ordinary meaning. You know, in other words, that you're gazing somehow on the naked face of truth and beauty. Well, it seems to me that what all this suggests, by all this I mean the human capacity for the psychedelic experience, the human facility for switching these linguistic channels from the beheld to the seen, what all this must mean is that history is nothing more than the transition phase from felt intuition, the mute intuition of the animal body, to fully expressible three-dimensional meaning, and that the descent into matter that technology represents is because you can't do this entirely on the natch. There has to be a certain augmentation of the human organism in order to do this. It may be pharmacological, it may be neurological, it may be nanotechnological, and then some part of the other two. But whatever it is, and we are coming up under the underbelly of meaning, boring from beneath, and that, you know, we're just about to hit the jackpot. And this is what the historical process is. And the proliferation of media, of the discovery of perspective 500 years ago, oil painting, airbrushing, digital sound, all of these techniques are this summoning of the image. So we are actually moving toward a kind of self-fulfilling process. It's something that we are defining for ourselves as it approaches, and it is defining itself for itself as it approaches. You actually experience this on psychedelics sometimes. I mean, the way it works for me on mushrooms or sometimes DMT is there is a black space. And then I hear the what I call the elf music, or the Irish band, and it's far away. And as it comes closer, I like see light. And as it comes closer, it both gets louder and the light fills the stage of awareness until finally the sound is subsumed under the visual impression of the thing, and then it's all around you. And it is, you know, this domain of self-transforming language. I mean, I call them language elves, but what they may be is nothing more than self-reflexive compound complex sentences. It's hard to tell what they are because we're not used to having our sentences stand up and embrace us. But nevertheless, the nature of reality is fractal, and it can't have been lost upon any of you that in a fractal universe, text is composed of characters, the characters of a given alphabet, but reality is also composed of characters, the characters like you and me who live out some kind of plot. Well, when you get characters into a text, in other words, characters made of characters, then you begin to feel the textual richness and the linguistic richness that seems to be not in the forefront of reality, but actually to lie behind it. I mean, the final conclusion, not the final conclusion, that would be preposterous, but the most recent conclusion that I'm coming to looking at the psychedelic experience is how phenomenally text-like reality is. I mean, it's more text-like than one should decently say. This is much more like a work of art than anything recognizable from my physics class. I mean, my physics class is about atoms and electrons and momentum and conservation of energy. My literature class, on the other hand, was all about personality, motivation, history, precursive, active, anticipation of action, willful suspension of disbelief. And these are the things that I see actually going on around me. And so it's strange, as we decondition from the being sold from the top worldview of Time Magazine and Scientific American and the Wall Street Journal, what we discover is ourselves active as art in a work of art. This is what the reclamation of experience seems to give back to us, is ourselves as very complex objects. You see, in the institutionalized world, we are defined always in ways that stress our similarity. We hear about voters, and I'm a voter, and we hear about women, and many of you are women, and we hear about yuppies, and we hear about the middle class, and we hear about those with liquidity in their portfolios, but everything is presented as a member of a class. We are always presented to ourselves as members of some class, and yet we experience ourselves as unique objects. But there is no reinforcement for that experience of uniqueness. I mean, you have a lover and they say, you know, I think you're wonderful and very special. That's about all the reinforcement for your uniqueness you get. And your mother also tells you this. But then you take a psychedelic plant and you discover, you know, hey, you know, I'm Christopher Columbus. I'm Magellan. I could be anybody. I'm not defined in these narrow ways. There are doorways in my reality to areas of experience as large as the area of experience that Christopher Columbus or Magellan took as their province. But it's all this new freedom is achieved by directing attention back at the individual. So, you know, a lot of the debate and talk that I hear is about saving and restructuring institutions and that sort of thing. I'm not very much interested in saving and restructuring very many institutions. I think institutions have done us about all the good we can stand at this point. And, you know, but then they wave the black flag of anarchy in front of you and say, oh, well, you're just an apostle of chaos and madness. Chaos, yes. Madness, maybe. But disorder, never. You know, this surrender issue, when translated out of the realm of the individual and into the realm of the collectivity, we all, as a society, must also surrender to what is happening to us, because I think history is some kind of psychedelic experience, and it isn't, there's nobody around who has the right plan. So it isn't about how we need to locate the people with the right plan and then give them a lot of money and get out of their way. It doesn't work like that. The right plan will emerge almost simultaneously in everybody's mind at the same moment. And in the meantime, we all are going to have this sort of half-baked plan that we can't articulate, that we can't quite bring out. It's a quality of the time. I'm going to talk this afternoon more about the quality of the time. But we can't think any more clearly than we're thinking at the moment when we're thinking at our best. Part of what history is a clarification of the human situation. And I think you have to press the envelope. You have to keep your nose against the glass, forcing the definitions into every new territory, but not anxiously. It's just, it's like a growth process. We can't evolve any faster than our language evolves. The language is the thing in which we're embedded. So the use of technologies like virtual reality or drugs like psilocybin and DMT or practices of various sorts, if they prove effective, to put pressure on the evolution of language. All spiritual disciplines, properly analyzed, can be seen to be courses, language courses. Now, to get you to think a certain way, to get you to carve out of the background of undifferentiated data certain things which you previously couldn't see, auras or acupuncture meridians or states of disease. I mean, it can be anything. But the mind sensitizes itself to phenomena by following language into the forest, into the forest of the unknown. And most people have no stomach for this kind of thing. Prefer to stay back in the village and just kill time grinding wheat and drying meat around the fire. But, you can almost make a kind of a fractal, quasi-reductionist argument and say that people are like electrons, and you don't learn what electrons really are until you get just one of them off by itself somewhere in a magnetic field, in a vacuum, and then you see what electrons are. If you have millions of electrons, then you have an electrical current. And an electrical current operates according to laws and rules and constraints completely different from an electron. And what we have done very perversely as a society is taken the laws of large numbers, how a million people act, how 10 million people act, and then we have applied it back to ourselves as individuals. Said, well, why am I not happy? 70% of everybody does X and I don't, and I'm not happy then. Trying to redefine yourself as against a very large body of statistical data. All of this is dehumanizing. All of this is bad mental hygiene, usually quickly cleared away by psychedelics. Because what they show you is, that you are unique. That you are unique, and that the confluence of space and time that you're operating in is unique, and that any model that is put forward is, number one, provisional. Provisional means it can be abandoned at any moment. And then the second and most important thing is any model you can't understand is useless. So, most of us can't understand most of the models. I mean, who here would care to walk to the blackboard and begin to describe the first stage of quantum electrodynamics to us? And yet we all know that our world is supposedly hung on this very well thought out theory that experts are in charge of. But notice, no pun intended, but notice that if experts are in charge of it, you're not. It's absolutely useless to you. You know nothing about it. Well, so when you start peeling away and saying, well, what do I know? You know, it turns out it gets into thin soup rather quickly. This is no cause for despair. This doesn't mean you should go back to night school and study quantum physics. That's the wrong conclusion. It means that all of this stuff that you thought were the high walls of reality are just smoke blown by somebody else. These constraints are not binding upon you at all. Somebody said to me once, their father had been a professional scientist, and he said once, I never would have seen it if I hadn't known it was there. And we all are in the habit of seeing all kinds of things because we know that they're there. And in many cases, they're not there. And you just walk through and you discover all kinds of things. I mean, I am convinced that anybody who has a major psychedelic trip, at some point in that trip, their eye falls on things no human eye has ever seen before or ever will see again. You know, it's that big in there. It's not at all clear that we're mapping a generalizable reality. It may be that it's just so huge in there that never do we pass through the same matrix twice. Well, that means you can give up on closure. You can give up on any theory that will ever give you very much of a more than provisional handle on what's going on. And I think this is probably a good step to take, to open ourselves to the freedom that lies beyond culture. Culture is a kind of prison, and the only way that we know to get beyond it is to dissolve its boundaries. Now, you can do that with psychedelics, and then you really explore the baseline of being, or you can dissolve it with travel. But then you dissolve your own cultural programming only to discover you fitted yourself into somebody else's cultural programming. And this, while, definitely educational, is like a psychedelic drug I'm not that fond of. I do a lot of traveling, but it's not the same thing as replacing space and time with some kind of alternative. That comes from doing the hard work on 5 grams in silent darkness. And really what you see, I think, is the morphogenetic field, the invisible world that holds everything together, the knit of it all, not the knit of matter and light, but the knit of casuistry, of intentionality, of caring, of hope, of dream, of thought. And that all is there, but it's been hidden from us for centuries because of the exorcism of the spirit that took place in order to allow science to do business. And that, you know, momentous and ill-considered choice then has made us the inheritors of a tradition of existential emptiness, really. But that has impelled us to go back to the jungles and to recover this thing. It's all of a piece, you see. I mean, these people in the Amazon and whatnot were keeping this cultural flame burning. But these cultures are now all dead. They are either dead or in a state of advanced suspended animation. I mean, the best anyone hopes for when they go to a rainforest culture is that it be somehow resisting the change all around it. There's no rainforest culture that is elaborating new forms and thriving on its own terms. So all the things that were learned, the legacy of the ancestors, is now laid basically at the feet of this high-tech electronic society. And the question is, you know, can we dream a dream sufficiently noble that we give meaning to the sacrifices that have been made to allow the 20th century to exist. I mean, my God, the amount of blood shed and, you know, infectious diseases spread around, metals ripped out of the earth, mountains moved, railroads laid across continents. All of this stuff as the means to reclaiming the human birthright that science hides from us. It's a very strange enterprise. I mean, it's hard to put it across because the thing is, it's real, you know, and we're in the effort, in the habit of thinking that the mind can move unobstructed from one edge of the universe to the other, that there are no secrets. But actually there are secrets. At least these are secrets. And hard to tell. I mean, I tell them, and you hear them, and we seem to have been allowed a cosmic dispensation. But why that is very hard for me to understand. I would have thought that this would have been headline news 20,000 years ago, right up until the present. Instead, you know, it's very tentative. Apparently, this is very threatening to us. We are not as eager to sail over the edge collectively as we think we are. So then it becomes the function of the shaman, the gadfly, the go-between, to carry information back and forth between these worlds. I'm convinced that if there were no shamanic pipeline, there would be no human life as we know it on this planet. I mean, there could be climaxed animal life. There is no need for this higher order linguistic style of self-reflection to come into being. It's that something is plotted. Something is working itself out in us. We are the cells of a much larger body, and like the cells of our own body, it's very hard for us to glimpse the whole pattern, the whole of what is happening, and yet we can sense that there is a purpose and there is a pattern. Well, the way you connect the pattern with the lower level is by dissolving the boundaries of the ego and the self into this larger thing. And then it's found to be there, reflective on many levels. It doesn't require a mechanism. Everything is obvious. If things don't appear simple to us, I think it's because we haven't thought about it long enough. Well, so that's sort of a survey of some of this stuff. Thank you very much.
And thank you all very much for listening to the program this evening. This is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's just about 7 minutes before the hour of 2 a.m. on the 20th of November, 2007. And I hope you all enjoyed the program tonight. We'll play another piece of music here by my friend John Cale to finish things off. But before that, we will say hello, happy birthday to Terrence Kemp McKenna, an amazing guy and someone who you all know a little bit better now, hopefully, after listening to this program. Come on back next week, 89.5 FM on the dial, KOPN.org on the web, and you'll be able to participate in a conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. And we'll be doing it all week from now, minus about 3 hours. And I hope you join me, okay? It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. All right, everybody, it's been a pleasure. Take care of yourselves. See you next week. Talk to you next week. In the meantime, here's some John Cale. And once more, happy birthday to my brother, Terrence McKenna.